This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this evening are Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
And Stephen Lockeridge.
Hello.
We have got a packed show for you in this episode. We're going to kick off with a German sci-fi movie called Final Voyage. Then it's off to Kenya for Endangered Species. A bit of vampirism with My Heart Can't Beat Unless You Tell It To. Bit of a candidate for one of the longest titles there, I think. Then we're going to Whitechapel for Ripper Untold. Well, where are we going? Rural farmland in America for Unearth. Then to high school for Triumph. And finally, God knows where, for Tiger, Tiger. Our short shot this week is a nifty little film called Somniphobia. And we got another film called Final Voyage for our DTV throwback. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first film then is Final Voyage. On a distant desert planet, two men, one an escaped convict and the other one of the bounty hunters sent to find him, end up joining forces when they come across an abandoned spaceship which is almost in working order. They manage to fly off the planet, but where could they possibly go? This is a German science fiction film, and I think it shows. It is very meticulous. This is like it's almost like one of those YouTube videos when they sort of show you how to fix a car, you know. It's these two guys. All it would take was for them to sort of turn to camera and break the fourth wall and sort of explain what they're doing. You know, a lot of the film is spent sort of like, you know, cleaning sort of grills and things and make sure there's no soot on certain parts before they take off, etc., etc. It does get a little bit more intriguing than that as the film goes on, but for my money, not much. Steve, what did you make of Final Voyage?
Yeah, very slow, very long. I mean, clocking in at almost 2 hours. And it's basically just a two-hander, two guys on a ship trying to fix it and get to a point. And that's it, really. It doesn't... There's little inklings of what happened to the original crew and, you know, looking at the logs and the past and what's happened and something that might be happening, but it doesn't really go anywhere with it, with what they were doing. I think you're right with it being the Germanness of it. It is very, very meticulous. You know, he's spending 10, 15 minutes while he's trying to fix the heating on the ship so they don't freeze and stuff like that. It didn't grab me, I'll be honest with you.
I'm not surprised. Rich, your initial thoughts?
I had a bad feeling when the opening credits started and they were just really, really slow. It's like the title comes up and it holds on the title for like way longer than necessary. And I was thinking, okay, come on, let's get into a rhythm here. And the pace, that was kind of setting the standard, really. Yeah, I didn't like the pace at all. I didn't get engaged with it. I was, you know, it took so long for the credit even to get through the credits and the opening scenes, whatever, that I could make no connection or investment in the film. It was kind of like, right, I was only watching it in the loosest sense from that point on, really. You know, I didn't have any patience for it. And the there's a couple of nice special effects shots which grabbed my attention, but then nothing actually happens with those. You know, they come across this monolith kind of thing in space, and I was a bit disappointed. Originally, it's called The Final Land. They've retitled it The Final Voyage, and dropped the for the UK cover. I was really excited about this one. It's got that generic. The UK release has got this very generic artwork, but at the same time, I was thinking, oh, I'm quite interested in this sci-fi movie, and the Germanness is really interesting to me. Unfortunately, we've got a dubbed version here. So, I mean, the two guys dubbing it, because it is basically just two guys in the whole movie, they do kind of give it a shot. You know, some of there is some performance in there, and it doesn't jar too badly once you're in the flow. But at times, it does sound like they're just like literally just reading lines in front of them, and sometimes the voices actually sound very similar. So it does sound like somebody reading the dialogue over the action or whatever. So that again sort of takes me out. I would have much rather seen an original language version, and that might have engaged me more, because then I would have been forced to read the information. Stuff comes up on the screen, which you get subtitled because he's filling in his log, which fills in some of the information or whatever. Yeah, I just didn't get, I didn't get on with this at all, to be honest. Space log, I call it.
Yeah.
There are some nice little touches, like, you know, this ship is abandoned or whatever, and you know, as they're sort of moving from room to room, or, you know, compartment to compartment, you know, you get things like bullet holes in the wall and stuff, and you think, oh, blimey, what's been going on? But it's never sort of elaborated. You know, whatever happened to the previous crew has no impact really on what's going on with these two, except it sort of sends them in a very particular direction. But yeah, it, you know, as you mentioned, that sort of monolith thing, you know, they come across this like sort of almost like an abandoned space station just floating there, and that's it. It's like, oh, that was weird, hey, you know, and just continue. Yeah. You know, and you think, why don't they got to land on the space station? You know, I'm sure there'll be something interesting going on in there, but no.
We've seen a few of these sci-fi movies recently in the last couple of years where it's like one or two people. You know, like these really stripped down. I think it was one called Solace that we watched that I actually quite enjoyed. I quite like that one.
Well, June Drifter is one that comes
to mind. June Drifter,
which was far enough, you know, a lot more exciting than this thing. It's meticulously well made. You know, the sets are good. As you said, the miniatures are good.
Effects. I thought the art design was great. You know, really was good. And like I say, the effects are good. Again, it's one of them films where, it's, to me, it was kind of pointless as well.
Yeah.
The ending is just, okay, there we go. Mm-hmm. That's it. See ya. And it's like, well, what's, I've spent 2 hours watching this.
Yeah.
For fuck all, basically. You know, it just doesn't go anywhere. If it did, then fair enough. But it doesn't at all.
No.
I'm just looking at the website, the official website called thefinalland.com, where there's loads of behind the scenes making of stuff information. Apparently the film was made funded entirely, it was crowdfunded. It was a crowdfunded film. Took several years, you know, to raise the money and make the film. So a lot of time and money and effort has been invested in it. So I don't want to do the film down too much, but for me, I just couldn't connect with those characters or what was going on. It was just the pace. I think, you know, there's potentially a really good short film in here.
Yes.
Like a film that's like 10, 20, 30 minutes long, but nearly 2 hours. Come on.
No. Yeah,
exactly. All right. We're not going to dwell on this too long because there's not a lot to dwell on despite its length. Scores on the doors, Steve?
I'll give it a 5.
Okay, and Rich?
3.
A 3? Oh my God, you know, that is a low score. I'm not admonishing it or criticizing it. I'm just pointing out, wow. That's...
I'm just giving it that for, you know, the fact that somebody did, there was effort involved in trying to make it. I'd hate to give it nothing, but yeah, can't be more generous than that, I'm afraid.
Okay, I am going to be a bit more generous. I'm going to join Steve on a 5. So 2 5s and a 3 for Final Voyage. If you like your sci-fi to be slow, ponderous, and meticulous, then this will be up your street. If you want something a bit more exciting, I highly recommend June Drifter. Go check that one out. Our next film is Endangered Species, Jack Halsey takes his family for a dream vacation in Kenya, but as they venture off alone into the wilderness park, their safari van is flipped over by an angry rhino, leaving them injured and desperate. Okay, so this stars Philip Winchester, who also starred in Rogue, the director's previous film, and you know they collaborated on Strike Back prior to that. And we got Rebecca Roman as his wife. And I have to say that Jack Halsey is a complete dick. Basically, the one thing holding this film back is the fact that the characters are so unlikable. But anyway, I'll circle back round to this and let's see what Steve makes of it. No, Steve, shit. Fuck.
Oh, I didn't watch the one.
You did watch it. All right. Yep. So I'll circle back to that in a minute and let's see what Rich made of it.
Well, the it's an interesting film because it is basically, it's not a sequel, but it's very much a companion piece to Rogue, which was the director MJ Bassett's previous film.
Indeed.
Which came out last year, also through Lionsgate. And basically all the component parts are essentially the same from that earlier film. In terms of location sort of thing as well. It's a very different film though, and it's probably much more of a, it kind of moves genres. It's very much a family drama, but it's got elements of disaster horror kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Sort of there was a film called Prey many years ago with Bridget yes. Moynihan. And she gets stuck in a car being attacked by a lion. And that sort of came to mind. So it's like safari kind of horror kind of mm-hmm. situation. There's been quite a few films of that type over the years. And also, but then the human threat element comes in, which again, they also did with Rogue, you know, so you got the animals mm-hmm. attacking, the animal attacks, which are CGI animal attacks in both cases. I think the CGI here is better than it was in Rogue.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And in the latter part of the film, then sort of the human threat becomes sort of the central thing. The animals sort of take a back seat for the most part, really. So it's kind of a three act thing. I liked it. Philip Winchester's character Jack is not. He's a pretty rubbish bloke. He's not great. The decisions he makes gets his family, into serious trouble. So, he doesn't want to pay for a tour guide. So they, he sort of tricks them and says, we get to do it by ourselves. And then they can't be bothered to wait to check in into the entrance of the national park. So yep. They're not actually documented being there. So nobody knows. It's all very well set up. It's all very well put together. Mm-hmm. And like Rogue, it's also a film with a message because MJ Bassett's very forthright on conservation issues. And that was a feature of Rogue and is also a feature here. So there's an interesting blend of lots of different facets, I think.
Mm, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, the stuff about, Jack's character that comes out, he's been hiding some sort of key information from his wife, for one thing. He's allowed his daughter to bring her boyfriend Billy along, while at the same time his son is come out as gay, got a boyfriend, of course he's nowhere to be seen. But at the same time, you can sort of say he's trying, to sort of be the dad, but failing at the same time. Even the fact that the thing got flipped over is because he went off-road into an area which was, particularly marked as a no-go area. Mm-hmm. And then parks the Jeep between a rhino and its baby. It's like, oh, for God's sake.
Well, it's his son driving, isn't it, at that point? And that's why it becomes really difficult for them to get out of the situation. I thought the attack, the sort of the CGI rhino attack, I mean, that is quite a nice, in Rogue, because it's hard not to talk about one without talking about the other. In Rogue, it was basically just the big cat attacks.
Yeah.
In this one, we've got rhinos and hyenas and a cheetah.
And a cheetah, yeah. A cheetah, I think it was a leopard, actually.
Oh, was it a leopard? Sorry. Yeah. And, yeah, so you get a nice variety in this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of leopard attack was really good. You know, really, it came out of nowhere. It's like, oh, my God, yeah, it's really cool. It is really good. I mean, you know, you can sort of, you can enjoy it and at the same time, you know, take the piss out of the characters a bit for some of their sort of dumbass decisions. But, you know, there's a nice bit of foreshadowing as well when you see the poachers early on and that sort of crack team of women sort of soldiers who sort of go after them. I thought it was a really good little moment. So, yeah, it's a very solid film.
What do you think about the messaging in the film and, like, the debates and discussions about poaching and you know, the justifications that the poacher has for what he feels why it's justified versus the, you know, the general view, which is that it's a terrible thing?
It's interesting that it's in there, you know, that this isn't a one-sided sort of thing. But at the same time, you know, it is the bad guys who are saying it sort of thing, you know. Yeah. So you do get that impression that, yeah, they're just sort of trying to justify what they're doing.
I think it's an interesting counterpoint, though, that they did bother to not make it completely one-sided, that they did try to think of a rational reason that somebody might justify to themselves that they do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean that's one thing, but you know, when you start going into murder and stuff, it's sort of, you know, your argument, so you kind of lose the high ground.
Yeah.
When you start murdering tourists, you're sort of like, oh, you're on a slippery slope, I think.
What do you think of the villain, the human villain of the piece?
He did get a little bit cartoonish, I think, but. Overall, I thought it was very good. Was it Jerry O'Connell playing?
Jerry O'Connell, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so, yeah.
Who apparently is married to Rebecca Romijn, which I didn't know.
That because they were both in Satanic Panic.
Right, okay, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good little film as well.
Because all I noticed was, oh, she's just Rebecca Romijn now, whereas she used to be Rebecca Romijn Stamos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, this is a good sort of solid film. You know, I miss the you know, the gunplay from Rogue, because that's the sort of thing I like. But at the same time, this is a good sort of adventure film. I thought, you know, a bit of survival adventure sort of thing going on. It worked really well.
And the other that was the thing, because it's not an action film, but they try to sort of shoehorn a little bit of action in, as in, like you mentioned those the women at the start. They kind of show them and then they sort of conveniently turn up. Is it them who turns up or it's like some other group?
It is them
who turns up. Yeah. So that's an interesting element. If that's a real thing, that's actually quite an interesting thing that they've incorporated, but it is kind of sort of shoehorned in to like give a little bit of an action, action beat.
Yeah.
The daughter in the film, Zoe, mm-hmm. is actually the director's daughter. Isabella Bassett, who co-wrote the screenplay as well.
Oh, interesting.
I thought she was good. I thought the whole cast was good, really. So don't like the dad. I didn't recognise him. I don't remember what character he played in Rogue, and I've not seen Strike Back. So I just thought he wasn't very appealing as a lead. I didn't like his glasses and stuff. So.
Obviously trying to make him as much of an everyman as possible, you know. Whereas, I mean, in Rogue, he was the second in command guy, basically. Mm-hmm. He is the other guy who survives in Rogue. So this one, you know, they're going for more of a sort of Willy Loman kind of thing, you know, sort of the death of a salesman. Sort of look, I suppose. You know. It's just the character, you know, the fact that, you know, he's a bit of a bigot and, you know, his ego is bruised by what's going on. And the decisions he's made or continues to make are just the wrong decisions all the time. You even find out that he hasn't even taken out proper travel insurance. Yeah, at one point, it's like, yeah, we've already got third party travel insurance.
So and the other thing is, he's an oil man, so he's representing the damage that's being done by big business, or you know, the West in general, to the whole world, and not just, you know, the localized problem of poaching, which is, as you know, sort of a big idea that they've tried to throw in there, and they don't dwell on it too much, but everything in there is sort of trying to serve a purpose, which I'd also think they've handled that stuff really well.
I think they did. You know, you don't feel like you've been hit over the head with issues, you know, in this. It is first and foremost a slice of entertainment.
Yeah. And the director says as much on the disc, which, by the way, the DVD is loaded with extras. There's loads of stuff from, like, Talking Heads from everyone involved, and two commentaries. So it's quite a good value, you know, if you're interested, quite a good value disc to pick up.
How are you going to score this one, Rich?
I'm going to give this a 7. By the way, it was also originally called Kenya when it was filmed, and it was made entirely. It was the whole production was during the pandemic.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm going to join you on a 7 with this one. It's very entertaining. Definitely worth checking out. Our next review is My Heart Won't Beat Unless You Tell It To. Teenager Thomas is suffering from an illness which makes him crave human blood and suffer great pain in sunlight. His elder siblings, Dwight and Jesse, do their best to cater and take care of him, but how much longer can they keep it up? So this is a vampire film where they don't talk about vampires, and they've kind of stripped down the whole idea to its barest essentials of needing to drink blood and having to avoid sunlight. Everything else is sort of thrown out the window, and it is very much a sort of misery as horror movie. So, Steve, what did you make of My Heart Won't Beat Unless You Tell It To?
Now, I saw the trailer for this the other week, and as I'm watching it, I'm thinking, Christ, he's annoying as hell. He just needs a bit of a bitch slap to sort himself out, because in the trailer, he acts like a spoiled child.
Mm-hmm.
But when you watch
Thomas.
Sorry, Thomas. But when you watch it, you do understand that, you know, he is obviously quite naive in his actions, and he's a spoiled brat, basically. And, you know, his siblings are doing more or less everything for him. He's just trapped in the house, no friends, and wants to kind of be just a normal kid, you know, a normal teenager or whatever. And this actually really, really dragged me in. I was quite surprised, to be fair. Because, like I said, once I've seen the trailer, I thought, no, that doesn't seem appealing to me at all. And then get the link, start watching it. And again, it is kind of reminded me of, was it Rose?
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, it's basically the same with that, but it's siblings rather than a partner. Mm-hmm. But this just grabbed me a bit more. You know, certain things that the sister does, which I weren't too impressed with, you know, regarding the prostitute. You know, the brother's trying to get through and do what he can. She's obviously, you know, the matriarch of the family, and she just starts taking over basically when he can't handle it. And then you got like the last 20 minutes where the kind of twist ending, not twist ending, but actually the story actually moves on. And I really enjoyed that, actually. I thought it was really well done. But I thought it was really well shot. It maybe could have done a bit of tightening up, maybe losing 5, 10, 20 minutes or something like that. But all in all, I actually did enjoy this.
Cool. Rich, what do you make of this one?
I think the title is a slight problem with the film. Fact that you've called it my heart can't, was you said my heart won't beat unless you tell it to. The title is My Heart Can't Beat Unless You Tell It To.
Okay.
So and it's just not a title that you know, catches you or grabs you or you know, is memorable. You know, it's easily. So people actually looking this up might have a bit of difficulty. I don't know what it is about movie titles with the word heart in being really long, because I when I was watching it, I was thinking, we've had stuff like this before, like The Heart is Deceitful Above All Things, Dario Argento's film, The Beat That My Heart Skipped. Why do movies where they're trying? But in this case, the title comes from a song that is played in the movie, so that it's actually got its origins as a real, as a song that was, I guess, is out there in the world. Must be a real song, I presume. The film itself, yeah, Rose immediately came to mind, as did other things. As I mean, same as when I watched Rose, like Let the Right One In and whatever comes in. But you've also got a bit of Texas Chainsaw Massacre in there, but from the family's point of view, it's more about their domestic situation than, you know, trying to, I mean, it's not like Texas Chainsaw in any other respect. It's more a case of, you know, this sort of family sort of on the fringes. You know, they don't have any money. They're very poor. You know, they've got like a hand to mouth existence, but they're trying to feed themselves. You know, the family in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre are, you know, the place they work, it's going to have business and everything. So they're cannibals and live in this, you know, the way they're living because of that kind of situation. And these kind of people, even though they're in a much more of a suburban location, are kind of the same. So the entire context of how they got into this situation is in my, as far as I recall, never delved into.
No.
But we do come to discover that it's not like a couple of parents with their kid. It's actually their brothers and sisters. We don't know what happened to the mother and father. The older brother and sister after the younger. He seems to be a vampire, but not in the, you know, fangs kind of sense. Like you say, it's very stripped down, sort of more realistic sort of take on it, which other films are out there that have done this, but I can't, you know, nothing springs to mind.
Martin.
But the George Romero movie. Yeah, good. That's a good shout. Yeah, I like Steve, though. I was really drawn into it. I've never quite understood what mumblecore is, but I was kind of thinking, is this a mumblecore horror movie? I don't know. It's kind of very dour, I would say. And, you know, people having these conversations and, you know, dealing with stuff and not sure what to do with their lives and stuff. And the lead guy's got a beard and, you know, he could be in a, you know, it could be in one of those sort of drama, you know, bleak drama kind of movies, and he's, you know, he's trying to move on with his life. And
he is in a bleak drama movie about trying to move on with his life. That's exactly what it is.
No, I mean, but without the horror. I mean, you know, this is a horror movie with, you know, with murders and whatnot, and they're out, you know, they go out, you know, to procure, you know, life sustaining blood, and I think it's all very well handled. It's all shot in like a 4:3 frame, not in the Zack Snyder sense, but it's you know, it's very arty, and you know, the narrowness of the frame at times keeps characters intentionally apart, and then there's like a moment later where the camera sort of moves to sort of bring them together. You know, it's very considered what they've done with it, and but it's a real slow burn, ambient score, kind of, you know, lots of sounds of wind and stuff. Very melancholy. Not a bright and breezy. It's not Fright Night, you know.
No, definitely not.
This is my issue with it. I mean, yeah, on the plus side, it is very well made and acted. As you say, the aspect ratio is quite interesting. I felt it sort of kept the characters sort of, you know, if characters in frame are going to have to be a lot closer together, you know, than if you had sort of more widescreen aspect.
Yeah.
It starts with a brilliant murder, you know, quite shocking, quite brutal when it happens. And, you know, it develops this idea that, you know, even though Thomas is the vampire, shall we say, he's not the monster. Basically, the monster is the situation and what it's done to his brother and sister. There's a conversation that Jesse instigates talking about the prostitute you mentioned, and yeah. sort of saying, "Look, no one's going to miss her. You know, we could easily kill her off." And you know, obviously, he's not too keen on. Well, he's not too keen on the conversation, let alone you know what yeah. she's talking about. So that was all very interesting as well. But this is there's very little entertainment here. This is almost like a Michael Haneke film, you know, in that it's like, well, you want a vampire film? Well, here you go. Ah, but I'm checking out all the trappings. And, well, you know, if you're... Yeah. And if it was a, you know, if vampirism was real, let's say, and, you know, your diet was purely blood, then that's not going to be very nutritional or nourishing. And, you know, you are going to be this sort of sickly person, basically. You're not going to have sort of special powers and all the rest of it. So, you know, it's that kind of thing. It's like looking at it as like, and just stripping it down to being, you know,
a real
portrait of misery, basically, is the way I looked at it.
Yeah.
Any more thoughts on this one, guys, before we wrap it?
Not really. I think I've said everything. Under the in terms of the sort of stripped downness and being more dramatic, you know, the bike thief that we watched a few weeks ago, that was a sort of ostensibly had the same kind of desperation to it.
And I
and that was kind of more of a, you know, that was kind of tentatively a thriller. In this way, in the same way that this is kind of tentatively a horror movie, but I would say this is more of a horror movie than that was a thriller. This is
a vampire movie if Mike Leigh directed it or someone, you know. It's a kitchen sink drama from you know, Birmingham or somewhere.
Well, literally, because they are a lot of scenes do take place in a kitchen.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so Steve scores
7.
Okay, Rich.
Yeah, 7 from me as well.
And it's a 5 from me. Sorry to drag down the average, but there you go. 2 7s and a 5 for My Heart Can't Beat Unless You Tell It To. Our next film is Unearth. When a local farm agrees to allow a gas company to start a fracking site on their land, it causes deep tensions in the community and proves not to be the answer to their problems either. Not only that, but the operation unleashes something primordial which has been lying dormant deep under the ground. We were just talking about a vampire film which sort of stripped everything out and, you know, even the entertainment value as far as I was concerned. This takes the idea of a creature sort of living under the ground and sort of like mutating and affecting people. And again, it strips out anything remotely entertaining about it. This is a fucking misery fest from start to finish. We got Mark Blucas as the head of one of these farms, who agrees to allow a fracking company to come on and, you know, start operating on his land, thinking, you know, he's going to finally get some financial gain out of it. And you know, and I'm sure this is true to life. You know, he gets totally screwed by this company, basically. And not only that, but the fracking releases this ooze, this sort of mutating thing, which affects people. Steve, unearth me. What did you think of this?
Stick me back in the earth, because this was absolute bollocks. I'm sorry, but you've got an hour's worth, like you say, absolute goddamn like misery porn in a way, you know. And it just comes out of nowhere. There's like no build up to it or anything. All you see basically is a drill going through, and the ground breaks a bit and the water bubbles, and that is it. There's no explanation. There's no building on what's going on. They just all start going mad, and then a baby literally...
That's a horrendous scene.
That's what I mean. There's no build-up to it. There's no, oh, he's coughing, he's sputtering, you know, Normally something like this, someone will cough up a bit of blood and you're like, right, well, they're dead. They're dead. But literally, she puts the babe in the cot, goes in a couple of hours later, and it's just like a pool of...
That's how dangerous this stuff is.
Yeah, but there's no tension built there or anything. It's just, let's all send them apeshit. I mean, I'm sorry, obviously, the writer-director is obviously against fracking. I mean, without a doubt, it's just like, fracking is bad, so it's going to kill everyone off. And again, when it starts, all you see is, you know, the grandmother, the matriarch of the family, she's got like a bit of a sore on her side. Next thing, she's found in the woods with mushrooms growing out of her head and a thing through her face.
That was a good effect, though. That was some good effects.
Oh yeah, no, the effects were good. It was just the script and the story that let it down, to be honest. Because, like you say, you got an hour. It's what, an hour and 35 minutes, and an hour building up to 20, 25 minutes of absolute, not even mayhem. It just, you know, it doesn't build or anything. There's no lead up to it. It's just, you've got an hour. He sells the land to the fracking company. Then it jumps a year, and then over the course of one night, you know, everything goes to shit. And it's just like, no. And it was boring. Boring as hell.
Rich, did you get anything out of the earth?
I did. I did. I did like this quite a lot, actually. Yes, it is a slow burn. Yes, there is a lot of maybe too much, you know, character development and whatever before it actually gets to the crux of what's going to happen. We've got Adrien Barbeau sort of headlined as basically playing the same character she always plays. But even though she's in her mid-70s now, she's still as fearsome as ever. You know, she is fantastic. She's just perfect in that role. The themes that the film develops... brought to mind The Last Winter, Larry Fessenden's film.
Oh yeah,
where they're exploiting I think they're exploiting in the Arctic or something, and that, you know, they awaken something. It's a very different treatment, but a similar kind of message, I think, from the film there. But also, you know, the killer plant kind of thing that we've seen in other stuff. So The Ruins came to mind, which was the one where the teenage just go to the Mayan temple or something, and the plants start growing through them or something. I can't remember.
That was terrible.
It was more fun than this.
I can't remember it too much. Mark Blucas, who I probably haven't watched in anything since he was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV show. I thought, you know, he doesn't seem to have aged a lot. He's looking well. And I was quite, you know, invested in his character and his situation and his, you know, his family and the dynamics and there's a bit too much drama with the, you know, having affairs and all that sort of stuff going on. And then it kind of turns into David Cronenberg body horror to an extent. So there's a lot of 70s style to this. You know, this is the kind of film that, you know, you could, you know, the whole eco terror and fear, you know, of the environment and what, you know, the things we're doing to the environment, and the environment sort of fighting back. So it feels very much from the 70s, and so does the David Cronenberg stuff, you know, whether it's Rabid or whatever it is that he was doing during that time. So yeah, and like you say, the couple of visual effects, you know, not visual effects, special effects and prosthetics and stuff that are in the film are very impressive. Brought to mind things like stuff we've seen in like the Children of the Corn sequels, where they've had like corn growing out of the people and stuff like that. There is actually cornfields and stuff in this. I liked it. I thought it was very interesting. The ending is quite curious. I'm not going to go into it and talk about it, but it's actually quite a similar ending to another film we're going to talk about, which I thought was a curious parallel for this week. You know, that we've watched two sort of quite dramatic films with essentially the same, you know, puzzling ending. So yeah, that's my two cents anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got nothing to add other than what I've already said. I did not get on with this at all, you know, and I thought this is going to be my savior film for this week. It's been a heavy week for the films we're actually reviewing, as you'll hear. And I thought, yeah, well, at least the creature feature is going to perk me up. And it was the opposite. It was, it's just so oppressive, you know. And obviously, the plight of farmers in any country, you know, is worth a spotlight. But yeah, this.
You know what you should have done? You should have gone into space. You should have teamed up with Christopher Nolan and gone into space.
Indeed. Yeah.
You could have talked to his daughter from a bookshelf.
Indeed. No, you're talking to someone who actually hasn't seen Interstellar. But there you go.
Right, so you've got no idea what I'm talking about.
No, actually, I do, because I'm a person of the world. I just don't want to watch it. All right, scores on the doors for Unearth, Steve.
Four.
Rich?
Yeah.
I'm going to give it a 7, but I say if you've never seen The Last Winter, definitely check that out, because that is really good. That's a much better, I think, treatment of a similar idea.
Or Blood Glacier, that's another one.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Oh, yeah, I think it's Danish. Danish or Norwegian. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm giving this a 4 as well. This has just battered me, this one. It really did. I just want to see some monsters, and I get this. Oh, misery.
Goo, you get goo, that's goo. What you get.
Misery
and,
goo.
And you get a baby liquefying.
Thank you. Yes, 2 4s and a 7 for Unearth. Our next review is Ripper Untold. When a killer stalks the streets of Whitechapel murdering prostitutes, a seasoned detective finds himself collaborating with a local medical examiner as he tries to unravel the case. However, the doctor has his own dark secrets to worry about. This is directed by Rich Steve
Lawson.
Lawson, who we've come across before with things like
Essex Heist.
Of course.
Yep.
I kind of like this one. It's very play-like. You know, it's almost as if it was, for the stage. But I did actually get something out of it. It's weird that they didn't go with the actual characters who were involved in the case, because, you know, Jack the Ripper is a very famous case. And I think the detective was a guy called Aberline.
Oh, yeah.
Johnny Depp played in From Hell, you know. He was an actual detective. This does sort of hit a lot of the right beats, you know, from the actual sort of case, and it does sort of give quite an interesting spin on who the Ripper could have been. So yeah, I probably of the films the last couple of films we talked about, this has not been bad. Steve?
Yeah, I agree, Dave. I really enjoyed this, actually. As you say, it's definitely the budget isn't there. I mean, I think there's literally, is it 4 locations?
Yeah, one of them is a set of stone steps, which I thought, you know, this probably is the most Victorian part of London we could, you know, we can actually use.
Yeah, you've got like that in the policeman's office and the examiner's table, and that's about it. But like I say, it is very staged. The performances are quite stagey as well, in a way, you know, it's quite hamming it up to the back seat, shall we say. But overall, I did actually really enjoy it, and it kind of reminded me of Gotham by Gaslight, the Batman
one.
It had that kind of vibe going on with me. And again, halfway through, guess the twist and whatever, but even when it came, and you're like, yeah, fair enough, got it. But it was still enjoyable. I really enjoyed it. You've got the medical examiner who's clearly an alcoholic from the start, but he drinks to get blackout drunk, and so obviously creeping into his head. And I even found like the policeman really affable and just, he just wants to get on with his job. He wants it done.
Yeah.
And then you've got like the bloke turning up from the Whitechapel.
Oh, yeah, it's funny.
Member society or whatever. And it's like, you know, the Karen of Victoria, what Victorian time, shall we say. But it works. It's not over the top with the violence, really. There's a couple of like gruesome bits in the autopsy. But that's about it. But cool. Overall, I really enjoyed it.
Rich.
Yeah, so this is the second sort of British history period horror that Steve Lawson and Creative Studios have done. The last one was Bram Stoker's Van Helsing, which unfortunately I haven't seen yet. So that was kind of reaching out into sort of new territory as far as I could tell from, I haven't seen a lot of the films, but I've kind of observed Steve Lawson's career as he's gone on. It's a lot of contemporary low budget horror. Hellraiser was another one we covered. And this, I think, is kind of Killosaurus. He's done stuff like that. This, I thought, was a very interesting, mature horror film that wasn't predictable. A lot of stuff you can generally tell what's going to happen, where it's going to go. Because of the nature of the Ripper case and the fact that it was never solved, I didn't really know where the story could go, what they were going to do with it. So it is, as you say, it's very much a character kind of piece where they follows a kind of a procedural angle. But we've also got a cast of unknowns who all, in my view, give very good performances. But because it's a cast of unknowns, you don't really know what to expect or anticipate. So the ending, there is a kind of a, Steve said, he saw it coming. And maybe I should have seen it coming, but I thought it was very well handled. The ideas and stuff and the way they pitch it. I thought the limited budget was handled well with the sets and locations. I thought they looked very good. I thought the cinematography was the way it was all shot. So the limited sets that they put together and the way the whole thing was shot, I thought looked quite classy. And the performances, say, really were very good in my view. And it just sort of elevated it that bit more. So it kind of it punches above its weight, I think, in terms of the realm that it's the low budget horror sort of realm that it's in. You know, it's not taking any easy outs. It's trying to actually do something really fairly complex, especially, trying to do a period film when you've not got the money to do it in the same way as a From Hell. You know, that's really challenging. And I think they rose to the challenge quite well. There's establishing shots of London where they've carefully just shot Big Ben and, the Elizabeth Tower, high enough so you don't see the streets and stuff. But I didn't mind that. The score is fine, but a bit repetitive. It's, it is kind of the same themes over and over again. But I was, it was the characters, really. I really thought the performances of... Now, I wish I knew who the actors were playing each of the different characters were. I think there was Jonathan Hansler, and I think he was like the coroner character, but the detective, I can't remember what his character's name was to be able to credit
the actor. He's Phil Malloy.
That's Phil Malloy, is it? Yeah, I thought he was really good because again, you're putting an older gentleman in the lead, two older gentlemen basically are the leads in the movie. I think to do a film like this, it's quite risky, but I think the risk really pays off, really makes it stand out, and it makes me even more keen now to go back and try and check out Bram Stoker's Van Helsing.
Yeah, we saw the trailer for that, didn't we, a while ago? But
we did, and we are credited on the cover of that film, but unfortunately we haven't
seen it. At all.
We saw the trailer and we made a comment on based on the trailer.
Yeah, never mind. I like this, as I said. There's one element I did like, which is kind of a modern element And that's to do with the character of Stubb, who's the reporter, being outed as the guy who wrote the letters. You know, he calls himself Saucy Jack and things like this. You know, that apparently now was, they have...
Is that a real thing?
Well, the letters were real. You know, he did supposedly write in. But I think they've now decided that he didn't actually write the letters. You know, they were either made up by, you know, the press or even somebody within the police did it. But yes, yeah, so that was an interesting element to put in there, I thought.
Temporary thing, fake news and all that.
It is a little bit, but it works really well. And I was quite well, you know, nicely sort of wrong-footed with the, you know, who the actual, you know, I was a little bit surprised they did actually decide to try and name somebody, you know, to sort of pin it on. Mm. Because as we know, it is a sort of infamous unsolved case. Excuse me. But yeah, this does work very well. So scores on the doors, Steve.
I'm going to go an 8 on this.
Cool. Rich?
I'm going to go an 8 as well.
Sod it, why not? Let's go for an 8. It's 3 8s for Ripper Untold.
I've got one last passing comment, which is the fact that the film is only about 85 minutes long, but 10 minutes of that is the credits. So it's not a film that outstays its welcome, but it's over and done by about 1 hour 17.
Our next film is Triumph. Inspired by a real story, a determined high school senior strives to be a wrestler one last time despite having cerebral palsy and goes to extreme lengths, crushing obstacles and inspiring others along his journey to prove his abilities. You know, when I looked at this and I clicked on the link and I thought, film set in high school about wrestling, oh, kill me now for fuck's sake. Jesus Christ. You know, this is coming off the back of watching Unnerve and My Heart Won't Beat, or Can't Beat, and the next film we're going to be talking about, and then this. I was like, Jesus, give me a fucking break. But in fact, this is brilliant. I thoroughly enjoyed this. RJ Mitt plays the main character. He's an actor who, as we know, does have cerebral palsy. We covered him before in The Oak Room, and he's great in this. He certainly looks way too old to be a high school student, but nevertheless,
it is in college. I just want to interject. Yeah, it's. I think he goes to
It says when he walks in, it says Hillsborough High School.
Yeah.
Yeah, and doesn't he then go to? He becomes a freshman at college, doesn't he?
No, this is final year.
That's his signing in day.
Yeah, this is final year.
He's just moved.
Yeah,
I apologise. I don't understand the way the American school system works.
Anyway, yeah. But he's really engaging in this. You know, I like that sort of scene where you know, he goes to sort of like check in, you know, with his schedule, and they're like, oh, you poor dear, you must want this special school over the other side of the corridor. He's going, no, I'm here to, you know, finish my high school. And he has to go to the principal to sort of like get him to, you know, sort of sign him in sort of thing. Which I thought was really, really cool. I really liked it. You know, and you're kind of expecting the usual sort of trappings, you know, there's going to be some bullies and all that sort of shit. Instead he meets Jeff, played by Colton Hayes. If you're a fan of Arrow, you'll recognize him immediately. And again, way too old to be a high school student, but never mind. And, you know, instead of being like a complete jock and being an arsehole, he's actually really nice, and they become good friends. And it's just really, really engaging all the way through. I really like this, surprisingly. Steve, your initial thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. Do you remember when we, back on the old days, when the only film that was coming out was Wonder, and we were both like, really
That's right. Bloody Owen Wilson and this poor kid who's like, you know, and then we're like, Jesus, do we have to watch this? And then we both watched it and thought, shit, that was really good.
I did exactly the same thing as you. I turned it on and thought, here we go. But it is, it does win you over. I mean, it's cliche after cliche after cliche, but he's great in it. And even Terrence Howard was great in it as well. I thought he was really good as the coach as well. The only thing I didn't really like was the dad character. He just came across as a bit of a wet lettuce, really. Yeah, a bit of a dick. But, and obviously, you know, you've got the bully on the same team as him. He, you know, once he gets beat by him, then suddenly respects him and the best mates, you know, and things like that. But it's just charming and fun. And I really, really enjoyed it, to be fair. And I wasn't, like you say, wasn't expecting it at all. But I think, is it RJ Mitty, is it? I will all my hands up right now. I have not seen much of Breaking Bad. I know it's like sacrilege in my house, but I've only seen
I've not seen a minute of it.
Not have I.
Well, fair enough. But, you know, it's great in that as well. And so, it just works really well. It's just nice. It's like a warm hug of a film, which, you know, we've all missed at last year, you know, because we've not been able to. But there's no flashy photography or anything like that. It's just nice and simple, nicely played. And it's a Ron Seal film. It does what it says on the tin to me, and that's it. Yeah. That's all you need.
Mm-hmm. Rich.
Yeah, a while back we did a film called American Fighter, which was set in the world of mixed martial arts, which was actually a sequel to a film called American Wrestler, The Wizard, which has never come out here. But I should imagine that's a similar kind of movie to this. In that case, it was a boy from Iran who came over to America, and he was, you know, facing hostility and whatever, and joins the wrestling team. And these typical sports movie cliches. So the very, you know, formulaic kind of thing that we've seen before, not just in the world of wrestling movies, but in sports movies in general, of which the Americans are probably the best. I mean, other people have tried it, and you know, I mean, there's quite a few British ones as well, but the, you know, the sports movie, the inspirational sports drama, is kind of one of the most established and most used film types, I think, that in Hollywood. And it's hard to sort of keep. I mean, to see basically the same film over and over again. It's like action movies or whatever. Some of them just work, and if they're done well, they're just always good. No matter how familiar the conventions and stuff are. And this is another one of those.
The high school wrestling, for God's sake, of all the things.
No, I did. In terms of the wrestling thing, I did think the climactic wrestling match went on way too long. That is probably one criticism, and it kind of just, the movie just ends basically straight after. So I felt the climax was sort of the climax didn't work for me as well as the rest of the movie. I think the build up to the climax. I mean, you could say that was other movie, similar movies as well. I just thought I kind of wanted a bit more at the end, I think, and a little less. You know, shorten the fighting and maybe a little bit more of an epilogue, maybe.
I like the ending, actually. I liked it had a sort of level of realism to it, a little bit of Best of the Best, almost. It's like, without sort of spoiling it, that's how I felt about it. And I think by that point, the film had said everything it needed to say.
Yeah, and no, I think... the cast was good. Jonathan Shake was playing the dad, and as you say, Terrence Howard's playing the coach. Sean Malloy pointed out on my Facebook when I posted that I'd seen the film, he said, how does it compare to Pride? I was like, I don't know what Pride is. And he pointed out that Pride was another sports movie featuring Terrence Howard. And I guess Terrence Howard is basically playing the same character again, you know, in another sports drama. But so I thought that was, I'm curious to see Pride now, but, you know, but that was quite another low key release about 10 years earlier in this. But Terrence Howard is good, but he's kind of not in it a lot. He kind of pops in and out.
Yeah.
He's not, there's not much emphasis on him. It's very much about Mitty and his mate, you know, because his mate goes through some stuff as well. And there's lots of, I'd say it's as Steve says, it's everything you've seen before, but it's no worse for it.
Yeah,
not at all. I think the only issue I had really was towards the end, during that sort of climactic sort of bout, and it keeps cutting back to his friend, and his face is just a plank. You know, there's no reaction to anything that's going on. It's like...
yeah, basically.
But never mind. Okay, how are we going to score Triumph? Steve?
I go over 7.
Mm-hmm. And Rich?
I'd go with a 7 as well.
I'm going to join you both on a 7. Just one final thing about the director for this, Brett Leonard.
Yes.
He's got a very interesting filmography in that he's the guy who made The Lawnmower Man back in the day, and also Virtuosity with Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe. So, yeah, it's very interesting and eclectic sort of filmography that he's had.
I don't know why. He had a really incredible couple of years, and then it kind of tailed off, and nobody really was hiring him for the big projects anymore. And, you know, he started doing things like Man Thing and various little, you know, DTV movies. It's basically been his domain since then. So it's really wild that he did this massive movie like The Lawnmower Man, which was a big deal when it came out.
Yeah,
you know, everyone's seen it. You know, everyone knows that movie. And, you know, other films like Hideaway, you know, might not have done so well. Virtuosity was a bit of a flop, but, you know, was that enough to sort of, you know, assign him to the doldrums or whatever? I don't know. But, yeah, it's quite strange. My passing, you know, final thought is the music in the movie. It's set in the 80s.
Yeah,
and so they try and throw in some 80s songs and that every now and again, but they clearly didn't have a massive budget for it. So for every song that they licensed, they've got someone to do like a bit of music that sounds like a song. So there's like a bit that sounds like AC/DC, and there's a bit that sounds like the Bangles.
Yeah,
but then they've actually paid for like Billy Idol and stuff like that.
Indeed,
which I thought was quite fun.
3 7s for Triumph. Give it a try. Our next review is Tiger Tiger. After robbing a pharmacy, a selfless and naive young woman and her mute friend kidnap a drug addict and then hit the road to distribute the stolen life-saving medication, but find themselves trapped in the fringe lands of a lawless and psychedelic city. It's been a tough week, Rich. the films we've reviewed, good though some of them are, haven't been what you could quite call entertaining. You know, they're a bit art house, bit message heavy. And then we've got Tiger Tiger. And I sort of sent out a tweet, you know, earlier this week about sort of the films we're covering. It's all about sort of people sort of dealing with this sort of oppressive element of society. You know, they're on the fringes of it and trying to survive as best they can. And that's kind of what we got here. We've got this young woman and her friend. We meet them at the beginning, robbing this pharmacy. This guy gets sort of caught up in the middle of it. And then when she goes to apologize, her mute friend instead kidnaps him and destroys his drugs, because he's a heroin addict. He's on methadone. And it just seems the most arsehole thing to do, what they do to this poor guy. And he ends up stuck with them. And I was struggling with this film for the first half hour, at least. I was... You know, the number of times I came close to switching it off, because I just hated the characters. I was literally hate watching them. But then the music in this film kept me going. The music is fantastic. The film score is superb. And eventually I started clicking with this film and eventually more or less enthralled by it. It's not an easy watch at all. It will test a lot of people's patience. But I kind of dug it towards the end. And there's a particular shot at the end which kind of freeze frames and then turns into a painting, which I thought was superb. You know, I really did. I went, wow, that was actually really, really cool. But it is, it is a difficult watch, I think, to get to that point. How did you get on with this, Rich?
Well, yeah, it's... I was very interested in the opening. I mean, from the start, it's going to be arty because they do the things with like the paintbrush kind of stuff starting at the beginning. But then it moves into the robbery, you know, to sort of establishing that. Now the world that it's set in is a bit unclear to me, but it's I think from what I've read, it's supposed to be set in like a pandemic sort of situation, unless I've misunderstood that. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff about people wearing face masks and everything, going to doctors or whatever it is, and everyone's there at the pharmacy. I think it's quite a well done, quite engaging opening, but then it becomes this, you know, on the road partly on the road, sort of meandering a road trip kind of thing that then becomes a settling in this this kind of community of outsiders, like Pink Flamingos, you know, where they're living on the fringes, or the Outlands in The Simpsons, when The Simpsons had to leave Springfield or whatever, and they went and lived in the Outlands, where everything's just total chaos. You know, it's a very, you know, drugs are all over the film, the movie, you know, everyone's on drugs and whatever, so the movie's got kind of this weird, you know, feel to it, you know, the characters, and the characters are all sort of basically spaced out all the time and stuff. I thought the performances were good, you know, some of the stuff's interesting, but I wasn't particularly engaged with it, and it doesn't have a plot so much. There's a little bit of one which kind of comes in at the end, but it's more a case of spending time with these characters, and it reminded me a lot of Larry Clark movies, although it doesn't have any of the sort of more seedier sides of that most of his films have. There's one called What's Up Rockers, which doesn't have any seedy stuff in it at all, but it's got that kind of artful, observant, you know, young, you know, a community of young people, essentially mostly young people. And then it's kind of, I don't know, quite a bohemian sort of environment.
Yeah. I agree. There's a film a couple of years ago called Honey, which this kind of reminded me of as well, which is sort of similar sort of age, sort of group of characters. But this is sort of a bit more sort of free flowing, and yeah, as you say, just spending time with these characters. The girl's on this sort of mission to take the drugs that she stole from the pharmacy and distribute them to this community. Except the person who sent her on this mission is crooked in the first place, and has basically set her up. Eventually it comes about this sort of stash of drugs and who's going to end up with them. But that's beside the point almost, isn't it? I mean, it's literally just about the characters learning about them, this sort of weird existence they end up in. There's this blonde girl who turns up, who gives this brilliant monologue about her mother committing suicide and her father sort of basically blaming her for it. And it's pretty heartbreaking, but it's so well delivered. It's definitely not going to be for everyone. And it's almost wasn't for me at all. But it was the music that I loved, the soundtrack for this, a mixture of sort of sort of new age, sort of punk and things going on.
I thought the music at the end sounded like the Pixies.
Yeah.
But I don't think it was the Pixies, but it did sound a lot like it.
That sort of stuff, yeah. It's sort of, you know, if you're a fan of the 4AD label, you probably sort of get a lot out of this. Yeah, so it's weird. It is the weirdest film I've seen in ages. It's definitely going to divide people into those who love it and those who hate it. I think I'm just about on the side of loving it, just about, I think. And so, you know, on that basis, I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10.
What? I'll come back to something in a second. I'm going to give it a 5, I think. You know, so I'm not quite sure about it. I don't really have anything hugely against it, but I wasn't really engaged by it.
Mm.
Another Larry Clark movie that sort of deals with a similar thing was it was probably his attempt at kind of Teenage Caveman was basically the one that came to mind. But there was another one called Another Day in Paradise, which I think had like James Woods or something in it. It's quite a good cast. It was quite a almost mainstream movie that he made that not a lot of people saw. I think that kind of there's a little bit of that in there as well. The guy with them, the drug addict who they take with them. Fun fact, he was the little boy in Big Daddy with Adam Sandler. Or one of them, at least, because that boy was played by two child actors. But quite curious. The title comes from a William Blake poem.
Yep. Tiger, Burning Bright. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, so that's the movie. So it's got this weird, you know, you kind of know what you're getting going in. You know, you kind of know what you're going to get going into it because it's got this very sort of curious title. And then, the opening is very sort of arty and that, you know, it's an art film, basically. But you've got to be kind of along for the ride. I think this is it's quite a punky movie, as you say. It's not just the music and some of the people who are in it. But, you know, it's got this very specific sort of renegade sort of feel to it. It's just kind of the world of it. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you, Mike, was did you see a parallel, as I did, between the very ending of this and that of Unearth?
No.
No? Okay. Because they're both kind of... they're both kind of endings where you're not quite sure where things stand, and the whole, in both cases, there's very much a hallucinatory kind of thing. You know, in this one, it's an actual narcotic, but in Unearth, it's more about it's a natural substance that sort of gets into them and sort of, you know, spins them out, and you know, they're seeing things that aren't there and whatever and stuff. So the two endings of the movies just felt so similar. I just thought I was quite curious, to me anyway.
I think I'd put everything about Unearth to the, you know, out of my brain by the time I started watching this one. Okay, so what are you going to score it, mate? Did you say?
Oh, I think we did just score it.
Yep.
I gave it a five.
Six and a five for Tiger. Mileage will definitely vary on this one, guys, but I think it's worth seeing. You know, you might enjoy it, you might not, but at the very least, see it, I think. Our short shot this week is Somniphobia. A desperate woman turns to a person with supernatural powers to help rid her of a demon stalking her dreams. I'm going to keep my powder dry on this one for a sec, so I'm going to throw it straight over to Steve.
I really enjoyed this. I thought it was absolutely really good. It starts off, bang, you're there. You know, it kind of reminded me of Scream where, you know, right from the start, you're in there and you're in the nightmare scenario, shall we say. And then it ages out, goes to the couple going to see the doctor, whatever, trying to sort out a night terrors or a nightmares. And the way it plays it, how he explains what he's done before. And then the ending with that twist, I thought was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, really good. This is probably one of the best shorts that I've seen that we've done so far. I think it's a bit longer, you know, it's like 25, 26 minutes. And I think with that, you get a lot more into the story and a lot more kind of character development with it as well. And the effects are great. I had no qualms with this at all. It really, really enjoyed this.
Cool. Rich?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I watched it a few, two or three weeks ago and made it a selection on the DTV Digest Short Shots Twitter account, which we post a short film every day that we recommend. Somnophobia was our 82nd. I thought it was really interesting. The expectations you have of the film when you click on the YouTube link based on the thumbnail that they've used are kind of quite subverted because it is a creature kind of thing. There is creature stuff in there, but there's a lot more to it, and it actually fits quite nicely into the sort of the realist theme, you know, the sort of issues based stuff that we've had this week. Completely coincidentally, you know, we've had sort of message based movies and whatever with endangered species and you know, stuff going on with them, My Heart Can't and all that stuff. So the it's a very sort of it's based around dreams, but it's also very realistic at the same time, so it doesn't go too fantastical, and it's very interesting with the characters, the way the young couple go to visit this, they've traveled a long way to visit this doctor, and the guy, it's like that film what did we watch a couple of weeks ago, they go to France, they go to stay at the guy's house. And the boyfriend's just being a complete douchebag. Yeah. You know? And it's kind of the same in this. He's kind of like, you know, being a jerk. It's like, look, you know, be trouble. Oh, come on, you know, whatever it is you're going to do, just get on with do it and all that sort of stuff. Am I right in saying that? I mean, it's been a couple of weeks since I've seen it. I'm remembering he's a bit of a jerk. Yeah. And so this guy who they've gone to see, they don't really know what he's going to do for them. And that kind of gradually comes out over the running time, which I think is very well planned. You know, it is 25 minutes, but it doesn't drag at any point. You know, even though largely it's just conversational, stuff starts coming out. He tells, you know, little aside stories or whatever, which all sort of come into play. And then, as Steve said, it's got kind of this kind of killer twist at the end. And what is actually all going on is really good.
Yeah, this was a highlight for this week, that's for sure, after the films were done. I don't know if any of you've ever had this, where you sort of wake up in the middle of the night and you see a shape in your room, and then it takes you a moment to realise it's just like something hanging off the back of a chair or something, you know. You know what I mean? And you get that sort of thing here. You know, that's where I thought this was going to go originally, when you see like a shadow the other side of the door. And it's like, you know, is she seeing something or is he just imagining it? And then, of course, you know, we find out which way that's going. This is just so well done. And I could really see this being developed into a 90-minute feature, you know, quite easily. But the dialogue is superb. You know, the back and forth between the characters, it really works. The little bits of information that sort of come out. The makeup effects for, you know, the various creatures that we see, and then that twist at the end, you know, that was the icing on the cake for sure. That was just so well done. Absolutely loved this one. Wholeheartedly sort of sing its praises from the rooftops. It's absolutely superb. I can't remember who the name of the director is for this one.
It's Dylan Vibart.
That's it, yeah. Definitely worth it. We'll put the link in the footnotes, of course. So, as Rich said, we've already done so for the short shots, but we'll put it in this one. For God's sake, you know, spend 25 minutes of your day just being enthralled in this brilliant story. Our DTV throwback is Final Voyage. Aaron is a bodyguard hired to look after Gloria as she participates on a cruise aboard the Queen Anne, one of the sister ships of the Titanic, which has been recently refurbished. However, disaster looms when it becomes apparent that the refurbishment cut too many corners, and a team of mercenaries also board the ship in order to rob its vault. So last week, guys, we covered a film called Sky Battles.
Yep.
Which was an asylum film about trying to down an airplane. And when this film starts, I thought, oh, because, you know, the poster and everything for this is, you know, set on board a ship. But it starts on board an airplane with Dylan Walsh as Aaron, protecting this woman, and terrorists trying to take over the plane, and he saves the day. But it is so over the top and ridiculous. It made the asylum movie look incredibly po-faced in comparison. You know, this was just so much fun. You know, this shootout on an aeroplane and people getting sucked out of the door and everything. It's just absolutely hilarious. And then the action moves on to this ship later on when we meet Erica Laniak's character. And then Ice-T and Claudia Christian board to take over. And, you know, a lot of people get killed on this one, Rich.
Yeah. The one thing, so this film is, I'm going to go backtrack and talk about the airplane sequence that you were talking about a minute ago, because that is a huge amount of fun. That really sets the tone and you kind of know what's going to happen. So they're having a gunfight on the plane, and basically a bad guy falls against the door. And it just opens straight away. It just immediately opens. Nothing is secure on this plane. And then somehow they obviously managed to close it or whatever at one point. But this is a very pre-9/11 movie. I mean, they barely even conceal their weapons. And they basically just, I'll pick it up out of the pocket that I put it in. And he just walks into the cockpit. literally just steps about three steps, opens the door, goes in. So it's hilarious. The character, Dylan Walsh's character, Dylan Walsh is, to me, most well known from Nip Tuck.
All right.
But he's done loads of other stuff.
I know him from this other series called Unforgettable.
I've heard of that.
I know the one.
Yeah, in which this woman has perfect memory recall. She can remember everything that's happened in her life apart from the death of her sister or something. And the way she does it, you know, on the screen is that she'll suddenly get this faraway look in her eye and suddenly tilt her head to the side, and then it'll sort of, you know, dissipate into whatever memory she had. And he was her partner in that series. And, it was a good sort of, you know, silly sort of police procedural stuff, which was originally it was going to be called The Rememberer, which is just which is apparently what the book was called that it was based on.
Oh, I see. Okay.
My daughter used to watch it all the time. Mm.
Me and my wife did. It was good fun. But there you go, silly stuff. Anyway, we digress. Dylan Walsh,
Dylan Walsh's character is introduced, and there's like this. I mean, it's very much of its time, but it's not dated very well. His character is very clearly homophobic, and it's quite weird because the scene before that plays out with the obviously gay flight attendant, which obviously is, you know, a very well-worn cliche. That character is actually quite well represented, I thought, in terms of their scene, but then his attitude and it's sort of like, he's obviously. You know, it's just like he doesn't say anything out, you know, overtly, derogatory or anything. Yeah. But he's clearly a homophobic character, which I don't quite understand why they felt they had to put that in there. But
it's funny, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, maybe it is. You say of the time or something. But I thought there was an interesting parallel there because with Endangered species, because that obviously also has a father character who's a bit of, you know, a bit of a jerk, yeah. And trying to deal with his son's being gay or whatever. So how quite this character would have dealt with it, I dread to think. But yeah, Dylan Walsh's character, he's pretty good. So that whole sequence, which is basically, it's shot in the cabin set, but all the exteriors are stock footage and stuff. It's quite well put together, I think. It's quite fun. And then, as you say, then it moves on to meeting Erica Oleniak. And also, it's the attitude, because, you know, his Erica Oleniak's character, yeah, very sexist. And the film even sort of reinforces that, because, you know, she's a strong-willed character and whatever, and then, but, you know, and she's flying this plane, but then he still has to sort of come in and rescue her and sort of like, so you think you can do these things, yeah, but you can't, sort of attitude.
That's the attitude, isn't it? Yeah.
So they go on the ship, and then it becomes Die Hard. So it's Die Hard on a ship, which is funny because they've got Erica Oleniak, gives that sort of under siege sort of memory of it. The ship seems massive in certain areas, like the boiler room, whatever, which is probably some...
below decks seems...
It's probably like a treatment plant or something where they've gone to shoot it. The ship is the Britannic, and I'm not sure, because they mention that it's the sister ship of the Titanic and Olympic.
I thought they called it the Queen Anne or something.
Well, they said it was similar to that or something. I think actually that's where I think the Queen Mary is where they shot it.
That's it, yeah.
But the actual ship, because they go out of their way to put these life buoys with the Britannic everywhere, so that they can reinforce that that's the actual location to match it up with the footage. So which I couldn't understand, because the Britannic was sunk. So I'm confused. I don't know. The footage of the Britannic itself, I don't know if you caught this, but this is from a 1974 film called Juggernaut.
Yeah.
So whether there's an explanation of how the Britannic was renamed or whatever from that film, I don't know, because I've never seen it. It's actually really hard to find. It's not very
good film,
that was Richard Harris and Anthony Hopkins and all sorts. So all the exterior shots of the Britannic are from that film, and even though there's 25 years between the two, I don't think it looks too bad. What do you think?
No, I thought it looked quite good, actually. Even some of the explosions, I think, were from that film.
I think so, especially at the end. But this was made by a company called Phoenician Entertainment, and they were basically obtaining all this footage from other movies and making movies to incorporate, to mix that footage with. And the director of this film, Jim Wynorski, J. Andrews, he did a fair few of these, including another one with Ice-T, which was called A Blaze, which used scenes from City on Fire from 1979, I can't remember. But and again, lots of 70s disaster movie kind of stuff. There's another one out there there's several out there with like footage from airports 75, airport 80, and all this. So this was a thing that was happening in DTV movies around this time.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, they do quite a good job of mixing it up, and they throw in some Deep Rising footage as well to sort of, you know, for some larger scale sequences, like when the ship's being flooded.
Yeah,
you know, all that flooding footage is, I think, from Deep Rising.
There's a scene where like the part of the bar sort of slides across the room as well. I'm pretty sure that's from Deep Rising.
Yeah, but all the stuff with the Chinese theme party or whatever, that's all from there as well. They've got so we've got Ice-T as the villain. And again, he was doing loads of these sort of films around this time. He did another one with Jim Wynorski called Active Stealth. But, you know, I quite like Ice-T. He did Surviving the Game, which he got to play the lead in.
Indeed, which I watched for the first time the other day.
Which is good, isn't it? It's a good film.
He has a very good, very sort of nuanced performance in that, you know, because he's playing this vagrant at the beginning. You can really believe him as this sort of crazed, sort of vagrant guy. Yeah, it comes across really well.
Yeah. And in this film, he's basically not got that much to work with. He kind of just gets to say some funny lines or whatever. And he sort of does a variation on, well, not even funny, but, you know, he does like a variation on the bad guy in Under Siege 2, where he says, "This is your captor speaking," and he and Ice-T comes in and says, "We're going to be your terrorists for this evening," or stuff like that. But it's obviously a low budget film, and some of the sets are like, especially when they first get on the ship and they go to the safe room, or I can't remember what you call it. You know, the
two security guards with like these podiums made out of shoebox.
Podium, that's it. Yeah, so they've got this podium, literally a podium, and a wall with a door. Like, and they just really easily open that door. It's like it is like Plan 9 from Outer Space sort of set design, set decoration, or whatever. But they max it up with the other stuff and whatever, and it actually works quite well. It's fun. They run around doing the Die Hard thing. We've got a couple of there's a couple of good people in it. I just can't remember their names, but Erica Laniak's good, but she doesn't have a lot to do. You know, she's kind of dragged around.
She was better in Shakedown, which we covered.
Yes, yeah, which again, sort of, she was basically doing the same thing again. You know, it's another Die Hard variation in terms of going up against the terrorists and stuff. Mm. She has a very short fight with Claudia Christian. Mm. At the end, but it is quite a disappointing conclusion. Claudia Christian's really good.
She's really good. She's the professional mercenary on this.
Yeah.
There's quite a funny bit where she's on the walkie-talkie and she's sort of going, "Oh, we've got two loose passengers." Goes, "Whoever did the head count is going to be in trouble." And then it cuts to the other terrorist. He's like, "Oh shit," because he messed up the headcount, which I thought was really cool. There's another funny line right at the end. There's another female character in this called Terry, played by Heidi Shantz, who's a sort of TV reporter who Aaron had had a relationship with before. And she's like totally not too impressed with his sort of his chauvinistic ways and everything. And there's a brilliant scene in the lifeboat at the end when the other guy sort of goes, that's a really sad sight to see. And she's like, "Yeah, but I don't think I'm going to warn her." She'll just thought it was really funny. He's like, "No, I'm talking about the ship sinking."
You mentioned that Heidi. Sorry, just to go back to Heidi Shands, she was in Universal Soldier: The Return the same year.
All right.
Also playing a reporter, if I recall correctly. Mm. Which I thought was quite interesting. She basically played the same role or a variation of the same role in two different movies in the same year. We have a lot of asides to her. She's kind of one of the ones who's one of the hostages. So when we have to spend time with the hostages, she's the one they focus on, and her cameraman who gets shot and stuff.
See, that, you know, the handling of, as I said, a lot of people die in this film, a lot of sort of collateral damage and that. But it's actually taken quite seriously. Like I say, you mentioned her cameraman gets shot, and it's not something that's just like thrown to the side. It's not a throwaway thing. It's a reasonable sort of plot point, and it sort of dwells on it a bit. And the same with the XO of the ship, who gets killed. To sort of, you know, force the captain to do something, and the captain's like screaming, going, "No, you didn't have to kill him, you know. So why did he do that? He hadn't done anything." And it's you know, usually it'd be like, "Oh no," and then that'll be the end of it. So it was interesting that it did actually sort of value some of the deaths as it went on.
I also thought the captain looked quite shifty,
and I thought he was going to be.
Exactly, me too. the sort of looks and glances or whatever that the actor was doing, it sort of sent the wrong message. Yeah. But it's fine. There's the guy who works down in the engine room.
Yeah.
Who's a very recognizable character actor, but he's, you know, one of those guys seen in a lot of stuff, but I just don't know his name. And I thought he was quite good, and he sort of brings a bit of humour and stuff to it.
Yeah, because he has that sort of moment of catharsis as well when he finds the the guy who, you know, just murdered one of his friends down there, and he's able to sort of take a bit of revenge. And he's going, "You killed my friend." Has he done it? You know, it's just sort
yeah,
of,
yeah, yeah. He does, yeah,
yeah, which is really cool. So yeah, no, this is a very solid film. I think I preferred Shakedown a little bit more than this one. It was another Eric O'Laniak one. But this is, you know, it's got a great cast, and it does use that stock footage really well. You know, not a lot of people are going to be able to spot footage from a film called Juggernaut from 1974 in the midst of this. And they do sort, you know, it doesn't stand out as bad as, for example, in Shakedown, for example, when they had the earthquake bit in the aftermath, and they used footage from the film Earthquake. And it was so grainy, you know, you could tell it was different sort of film stock, sort of straight away, and it does sort of take you out a little bit. But this sort of matches up quite well, I thought.
Yeah, and the I liked seeing there's like in the cast you've got Michael Bailey Smith. And there's a guy called Scott L. Schwartz, who I didn't know his name, but I reckon he's the tall, bald guy with the really tall. I mean, when he stands next to Dylan Walsh, he is enormous. and he makes Dylan Walsh just look really small. But he was in Fire Down Below, again, around the same time. So I remember him from that. And we've also got Jonathan Fuller, who I think was the villain in Skyscraper with Anna Nicole Smith. And a guy called John Koyama, who... I don't know, but I thought he was very striking, as he was like one of the he was like a lead henchman character. One of the lead henchmen. I thought he was good. He's like a stunt guy who's done all sorts of stuff, everything. So the I mean, Jim Wynorski movie, you know, all the movies around sort of this time with these stock footage movies, basically, they all seem to get really great casts together, I think. And you know, like even you could also mention that Ticker, the one that had Steven Seagal in it and Tom Sizemore, that was in, you know, so much stock footage from New Images. Yeah, I know, but you know, they managed to use all that footage and stuff quite well. But Ice-T turns up in that movie as one of like the ridiculously impressive cast list. He literally just turns up for like one scene towards the end. It's just like at random as like leading sort of the terrorists on the building stuff. Ice-T was just all over the place at this time. I know he became closely, I think he had a long running role on a TV series, didn't he? Like, Criminal Minds or something?
Law and Order.
SVU, Law and Order.
Yeah, Special Victims Unit.
He's done quite well for his acting. I mean, his acting career has been pretty good. I mean, this is an easy payday thing for him, really. There's not a lot for him to actually throw himself into. Dylan Walsh, I think, does a bit more. There's more for him and Eric Olaniak to sort of to play with. So I think, I like this. I think it's a lot of fun. It's not the best. It's not one of the best, you know, action movies of its type, but I think it is fun.
Yeah. I think for a Jim Wynorski film, I mean, the guy is... You know, he gives Prolific a bad name, basically. But I think The Assault is one of my favourites of his that he did, which is set in a sort of women's shelter. I thought that was superb. This is fun. It's, you know, it's the antithesis of the sort of po-facedness of the Asylum films that we've looked at. It's, you know, it's a similar sort of ridiculousness.
Well, because I was thinking of Titanic 2, the Asylum film Titanic 2, which kind of does a similar story, but without the terrorists. So it's working on a similar budget limit. But in that case, instead of using stock footage, they're using like low budget CGI and stuff. So I think they're made like, well, I don't know, 15 years apart, those two movies, doing similar kind of things on very low budgets. And I think this feels like almost like a blockbuster in comparison, because you've got, say, such a great cast and everything involved. And obviously you've got that footage from much bigger movies, which incidentally the footage from Juggernaut, they even use the timestamps, which I thought was quite funny. They don't just use footage, it's like the time of the timed points of the journey and the voyage.
I couldn't figure out why they bothered. You know, I was watching, I'm thinking, you know, sort of say like sort of 3:30 a.m. you know, sort of 19 nautical miles out. And it's like, from where? You know, to where? Yeah. What are you talking
about? Oh, yeah, they don't actually really well establish it. The other thing is, leaping to the end of the movie, it just kind of ends.
Yeah.
In terms of, we're not actually sure what their fate is. It's like, I know it's probably implied that they'll get rescued, but did they ever actually get a rescue message out?
I don't think they did. Well, they did.
The
bad guys did.
Did they?
Yeah, the bad guys sent out the signal.
So, I missed that bit.
Yeah, there was an aircraft carrier nearby, so like, you know, responding to it. So, yeah, I imagine they'd get picked up. Anyway.
It would have been funny if they did. It was left buoyant, because you know, like at the end of like Poseidon, you know, where you know, you just all of a sudden see these helicopters or whatever come out, and you know, you just have that sort of, oh, they're going to be okay kind of shot. In this case, it was just, we're just going to leave them floating here.
Anyway, we don't score the throwbacks, but we do recommend them. If you've got Amazon Prime, this is worth checking out. It's silly fun, basically. And if you know, if you're a fan of either Nick Tuck or even Unforgettable, then you know Dylan Walsh is a very good lead in this. And then you got the likes of Cloudy Christian and Erica Elaniak, and even Ice-T. So yeah, go check it out. And that is the end of this week's show. So thanks to Rich and Steve for joining me. And it's been a bit of a marathon, both in terms of length and endurance. But we got there, guys. So thank you for joining me.
No problem.
Thank you for your endurance.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting.
That sounds a bit wrong, though.
It does. But it's one of those weeks where, you know, it does prove you can't take things at face value. You know, I was quite willing to kick Triumph and even Tiger to the curb, but turned out to be really enjoyable. On the other hand, you know, the films which I thought would be up my street, you know, Vampires and Monsters from Under the Earth, turned out to be misery fests instead.
I think you're right. For me, Ripper Untold and My Heart Can't Beat Unless You Tell It To was one of the ones I was really not anticipating, you know, watching. But
yeah,
I did like that one. And Ripper Untold, so really surprised me. And I thought Endangered Species were going to be good. But for me, Final Voyage was the biggest disappointment. The German one.
The YouTube How to Fix Your Spaceship movie.
yep.
Oh, that's another thing. Can I just, sorry, about another passing, another final thought on Final Voyage. The computers, it's all very 1970s style. You know, they're using like Apple sort of, you know, screens from the thing. Yeah. So I think they're trying to make it in an old style. Do you think that was what they were going for? Because the computers, you would think that they'd have been way more advanced than that. I mean, this is quite a new movie. They could have used lots of different technology.
It kind of reminded me of, say, like, you know, the Nostromo and Alien.
That kind of vibe.
There is something to be said as well. Yeah, there's something to be said about how technology would actually stand up in that sort of environment. You know, because I work with the military and stuff as well, and a lot of their stuff looks really old school. And the reason is because it has to be ruggedized. You know, it has to be able to withstand sort of a lot more hardship than your usual sort of like tablet is going to meet. So you know, there is that element to it as well, I guess, maybe. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But anyway, so...
I've taken us off piece there.
well off piece. But anyway, we don't score the shorts, as we mentioned. We've done all the rest of it. Check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at the DTV Digest, where we make mention of the latest releases and the DTV chart. Also, check out our sister show, the DTV Digest Short Shots, where we discuss short films in every episode. Thank you for listening, and tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.